Mathis. I'm here in Dallas, Texas at Southern Methodist University, and I'm going to be sharing with you a five-year research project that recently been completed.
The conference is in lecture mode.
Working on
the conference is no longer in lecture mode.
I know.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
I don't know what he's doing.
It keeps telling me I'm in and out of lecture mode, so I'm a little confused.
Yeah, so am I. Maybe if someone in the audience could tell me if you are able to hear Dr. Mathis.
I can
hear.
Ma'am?
Yes.
I can hear.
Okay.
I can't hear her when you go to lecture mode.
Okay.
Yes. Same here.
Same here.
I'm here.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and leave it off mute then. My directions are to mute the audience, but obviously it's putting it into lecture mode instead of muting it. So if we will all just mute our own phones, if you have that capability, and so we can move forward with our discussion.
Can I ask, have people heard my intro now? Because from my side, I've introduced this three times, but I don't know if anybody's heard any of it.
No.
Okay, starting from the beginning.
From the beginning, here we go again. All right. Well, this is Patricia Mathis. I'm here in Dallas, Texas at Southern Methodist University, and I'm going to be sharing with you today research that myself and colleagues at the University of Texas, Carolyn Denton at the University of Texas in Houston, have been conducting over the last 5 years. The focus of this research has been on what happens when you take effective interventions that have been proven to be effective in small-scale research studies, when you take those same interventions and essentially drop them into the public schools and let them sort of run their natural course. So we've been observing the process of taking effective interventions to scale. My presentation today has two major sections. The first section is really a review of the research that we built our interventions on, and then I'm going to go through that the foundational information very quickly. And if you heard me last year, you'll recognize some of those slides as being the same slides. And then I'm going to spend the majority of the session today discussing what we've really learned about this process of scaling effective interventions. The research that I'm talking about today is a continuation of a line of research that I've been conducting for a number of years, but in particular over the last 10 years. So so 5 years were on scale-up, and 5 years before that, we were really looking at what are the best ways to intervene with children who have reading difficulties. And we really honed in on some very effective interventions that got the reading. We were able to demonstrate that you could indeed get the incidence of reading failure if you start it young, as in first grade, down to at least less than 2%. And I talked on that topic last year. So the question we've been asking is, well, why aren't we getting those same kinds of results with effective interventions in the public schools? And so that's the process we've really been examining. If you look at the first slide, I have what we naively thought we would be examining, and we're going to revisit this slide in its revisionary version as we go through the slideshow today. Initially, we thought there would be this very systematic process of taking the interventions into the school. It would be implemented, and then we'd move into sustaining and maintaining. And then eventually, we anticipated that the schools would eventually see this as the thing that they do and institutionalize it. And I frankly admit that we were very naive about that process. I'm sure some of you may be laughing to yourselves as you look at that. We found some things that didn't go that way, let's just say. Now, it's important to understand what exactly we were trying to take to scale. And we had two very effective reading interventions that I've talked about in the past. But what both of those interventions shared were that they were really Tier 2 interventions. They were designed to enhance and supplement the core. but they were also implemented prior to a child being identified as needing, say, special education services. So the objective was to prevent the need for Tier 3 services. Now, our version of Tier 2, or secondary intervention, was a very intense version. In many places, that version of what we called Tier 2 might be Tier 3 in a four-tier model. So I just want to be clear that we didn't have when teachers pull kids aside to do targeted instruction, some places call that Tier 2. We considered that type of small group sort of short-term intervention as part of CORE, and our Tier 2 was much more intense. So what we were trying to implement was more than just a curriculum. There were two different curriculums that schools got to choose that we did drop into the buildings, but what they also had to arrange for was the structure of a tiered model and figure out how to arrange this infrastructure to support that instruction. And so it's important to realize that when we're talking about scaling, we're often not just talking about scaling a particular intervention that has a curriculum that teachers just deliver. It also incorporates, you know, the personnel and all of the infrastructure changes that may also accompany trying to get that into place. And so that's what we were doing. Just as background, and I did share these slides with you last year, so I'm going to go through them very quickly. And if you've heard me, I present these slides relatively frequently, so you may have seen them before. What I want to address here is what we know about the possible impact of improving instruction at each of these tiers. And what I really want to attend to is the very last column that says the percent of children at the end of these studies that were performing below the 30th percentile, recognizing that at the beginning of the study, each of these studies had children that were performing at the 18th or the 25th percentile. So what percentages of kids can we shift
on my left?
Most at-risk categories?
Hey, Ken.
Excuse me, would you please mute your phone?
And what we see consistently is that when schools do high-quality core instruction, you really get the incidence of reading failure down quite a bit. That's just with CORE. So the question we asked is, well, what happens when you add on very effective tier into an effective CORE, not in addition to, or not replacing, but in addition to? And that's where we saw that you can get the incidence of reading failure consistently down below 2%, and in some cases even down below 1% with these children who were all within the normal range of intellect. So we're talking about children who were from that IQ range of, say, the borderline category all the way up into the gifted category in terms of who they were. So we were not looking at children with mental retardation here, but with children who have looked like they might be dyslexic or other things, high poverty, these are the numbers we were able to achieve. So that's what research that I've been involved in and others have consistently demonstrated, that it is possible to really reduce the initial failure of children tremendously. And as you turn to the next slide, you should be looking at some brain imaging. And I'm hoping that you're looking at this in color, because if you're looking at it in black and white, it doesn't show. You'll just look at some brains. But what you should see is that when we worked with children in first grade, well, actually what we did is we went in and looked at kindergartners and identified those children who were most at risk, looked like they had risk factors for reading failure versus children who did not, and went in and actually imaged their brain using technology. And you can, if you're interested in this, you can follow up. I do have the citation on that particular slide. This work was done mostly by Jack Fletcher and Dr. Simos at the University of Texas in Houston. But they used children from the study that I'm referring to, where that preceded the study that I'm getting ready to share with you today. And what we showed is that, indeed, children who have risk factors do have brain development that at least initially looks a little different. But as you look at the following slide, what we found is that after a year of our intense Tier 2 intervention, that the brain images of those children who initially looked at risk, who had different brain activation patterns than their non-at-risk peers, did indeed normalize. that what you see is a normalization in the left hemispheric region of the brain. I'm not going to go through this in detail with you, but it is very interesting to note that through good intervention, what we know we're doing is actually teaching how to process this information in a normal way. This was important because that process information normally end up with kids who act normally, versus if it was compensatory models usually are not as effective. So it's very exciting to know that we can indeed change the way that children's brains are actually processing text, and therefore they're able to not look any different from their less impaired peers. So that was the previous research. So now I'm going to move into some of the work that we've been doing in scale-up in our current research that is at the end of the cycle. And one of the most important things about Project Scale-Up is that we took our models into existing models. In other words, we took our interventions into schools and dropped them in and just observed what it was the schools were doing. So if a school already had a Tier 2 model, they continued to do that with the contrast children. And so we did have a comparison group in every school. We had our model, and then we had whatever the school was already doing. And one of the things that came out of that, just letting the schools do whatever they normally did and seeing how they did it, was that we were able to actually examine the effect of scientifically based intervention compared to interventions that did not look so scientifically based. And we identified these interventions as being scientifically based by going in and really observing what it is they were doing, and then looking to see if the number of minutes used, if they included the five areas of reading, or what was really happening there. And so we were essentially able to rate those different interventions that were already in the schools that we did not impact. So we were not changing what was happening here. What was interesting to note is the effect sizes of those interventions that really did align pretty well with science. In many cases, they were using interventions that had quite a bit of scientific evidence to support them, things like Project READ, and I'm forgetting all the different interventions we saw. But when the intervention was scientifically based, we saw pretty good outcomes. In fact, outcomes that were comparable to the interventions we were delivering to our experimental group. When schools were not implementing interventions that were aligned very well with research, what we saw is a big disparity between the outcomes of the children who got the non-scientifically based intervention versus those children who were in schools delivering scientifically based intervention. What you see there is effect size numbers. An effect size tells you the magnitude of difference. Magnitude of 0.2 is considered educationally relevant, and the bigger the effect size, the more different the groups. So an effect size of 0.5 or so is pretty healthy, and when we get up into the 0.88, as you see with Word of D, you see that's a massive difference. So I'd like to share this slide because it fell out of what was naturally happening in the schools, and it does show you that schools who are spending the same amount of money for intervention, time, personnel, et cetera, are not necessarily getting the same outcomes. So I always like to remind people that we really do need to be paying attention to not just how we deliver, but what we deliver when we're delivering Tier 2 intervention. We also have many students in our study who actually did not receive any Tier 2 at all. They were in what we call the control only or the core only condition. And so we looked at what happens in effect sizes of those children who got non-scientifically based intervention compared to children that got no intervention at all. And this actually quite shocked me. It's quasi-experimental, so it has more threats to validity. I always need to share that. But the fact is that when we did this comparison, we found that in many cases it was a negative effect size. In other words, children who got nothing at all did a little better than those children who were being pulled out to receive Tier 2 intervention using an intervention that did not look to be scientifically based. I always get the question of, well, what was that? And so I'll share with you that what it usually meant was that the teacher was assigned to deliver reading instruction, but she normally wasn't given a true program to follow or to guide her instruction. She was left mostly up to her own devices. They would use terms like, well, we're doing something eclectic, or I pull from different places, or there was a number of things that they said, but mostly they were not following a careful scope and sequence and a carefully laid out designed curriculum. So that's important to know, that science really does make a difference, and that we need to be careful what we're that we're not doing, putting in place just an infrastructure without also paying attention to the content of what is being delivered through that infrastructure. So now I'm going to move to Tier 2 instruction in the real world in terms of the outcomes, what we're seeing in different, in terms of what we're compared. This slide shows you what Tier 2 intervention was looking like in terms of the percentage of kids we're getting down, you know, the percentages of children still having failure. Compared to the 0.02% that we were seeing in the tightly controlled study. So there is a disparity here. And so part of our question is, why is it that more children aren't making it when it's being done by the public schools than when it's being done by just the researchers? Even though these numbers are not bad, it's, you know, I think we would all agree that getting down below the fifth percentile isn't terrible, but we can do better. So the questions we've mostly been asking are, what are the barriers and facilitators to getting research supported? When I say research supported, I mean scientifically based, proven effective interventions in place on a wide scale in our schools. And it's easy to say, oh, it's all money, but actually, well, that of course is part of it, but that's not the whole answer. So in terms of the actual interventions that I'm going to be talking about, there were two that we did scale. The first is responsive intervention, and that was designed by my colleague Carolyn Denton, and it is available from Cypress West now. It's now commercially available. And it represents an intervention that feels more like a guided reading, but it's a much more structured version of that particular model. It has, but it does use the authentic literature libraries and such. So what you get when you purchase responsive reading is a handbook with staff development, but that accompanies it. But within that handbook, there's many more structured menus and things than you get in a traditional guided reading kind of a format. Then the other intervention we took to scale was what we originally researched as proactive and is now called early interventions in reading, which is now commercially available through SRA McGraw-Hill. The two interventions both included systematic explicit instruction in how to analyze words, how to decode words. This responsive did include an analogy strategy that was not included in early interventions, but they both included synthetic phonic strategies. A major difference between the two interventions is that responsive used literature libraries and leveled text, where the early interventions focused in on decodable text. In responsive, teachers created their own lesson plans after observing students reading, and in proactive or early interventions, teachers followed a scope and sequence and set of daily lesson plans that were prescribed on the front end. So those are some of the differences. But our previous research had shown, and if you look at the next slide, I'm not going to go into the detail here, but what we found in our previous research is that these two interventions were essentially identical, and that they did share a corpus of the same critical content that we think accounts for why they're both effective, in at least in our small group research studies. So what we are looking at now is the process of taking one or the other of these interventions to scale. The first thing to understand is that when you scale something, schools are going to embrace the intervention or the approach that is most attractive to them. So our approach was to allow schools to choose between these two interventions. And what we found, interestingly, I think, is a clear demographic departure between these two interventions. When we do our chi-square analyses, it's just unbelievable. If you were in a higher SES suburban school district, you're 100% of the time going to choose responsive as your intervention. If you're in a urban, lower economic district, you're going to choose proactive. At least that's the way it fell out in our early interventions reading. That's the way it fell out. We presented both of these interventions, and we also had thought that the principals would be allowed to choose, but in our studies here, what we found is at the district level, school districts made the decision for their principals. They said, you may only talk to my principal about responsive, or you may only talk about early interventions. When we got down to the rural districts, that was more of a hodgepodge of what they chose, and that did not seem to flow along socioeconomic lines. So it's important to understand that because we are not able to really compare the two interventions to each other anymore because we have such clearly differentiated populations of kids. We're not comparing apples to apples. Even so, we learned quite a bit about the process of scaling. We have been working with 78 schools across the Dallas-Fort Worth and Austin areas for, we collected data in these schools for 4 years. It's a huge project. It was 255 miles from north to south, and then east to west it was 105 miles. And we did work in every kind of school district imaginable, so urban, suburban, and rural. So at the end of this, what we found is that in some places, this is not going to be a surprise to anybody, in some places, schools did a beautiful job implementing either which of the two interventions they chose. And in other places, they did not. I think there's probably no surprise there. So the question is, why? Why are some places able to do it when others are not? And what we also found is that there wasn't a clear difference between which of the two interventions got implemented better. And it also didn't seem to be a factor of SES or school type. So we found this to be very interesting. But we do know that the better the intervention was implemented, the better the outcomes for children. That relationship is quite clear. That those children that got the intervention with higher levels of fidelity had better outcomes on average than those children that were in classrooms that did not deliver the instruction as well. However, we've learned that it's not enough just to go into classrooms and observe once or twice, or in our case, we observed about 4 times across the year to get our fidelity measures. We learned that what you see in what I call the snapshot doesn't tell the whole story. I know that also is not a surprise. But what it doesn't tell you is how frequently, how the quantity of instruction, how often that was being occurring. And we naively thought that if schools signed up to deliver instruction, that certainly they would deliver this instruction. And what we found out is that sometimes that was true, and sometimes that was not true. And so when we look at this idea of fidelity, we now look at it in two different ways. We look at it in terms of the quality of delivery, so how the teacher was actually able to deliver the various strategies and techniques that were incorporated into the intervention that was chosen for them. But we also now consider the frequency or the consistency. In other words, are they delivering the instruction day after day after day as we would hope? And what we have found is that it's not the quality of the teacher's ability to deliver. We saw uniformly that teachers in our study across the 78 schools delivered instruction pretty well. We were quite pleased at how well they were able to deliver the various techniques. Now, I should share with you that part of what we incorporated into our model was a coaching model, and I'll come back and visit that. So part of why our teachers were able to deliver the various techniques and follow the script if there was a script or design the instruction if they were in the model that designed the lessons is because they did get coaching. So that supported them. But what did not happen in every case was the teacher's ability to deliver that instruction as frequently as we felt needed to be occurring. And I'm going to come back to why in some cases teachers were not able to deliver their Tier 2 intervention as frequently as they were supposed to from our perspective. But what we did find out is that given that the teacher's ability to deliver was pretty high, so we had no bad delivery. We had moderate to high quality delivery of the instruction across the board. So given that caveat, we found that in terms of those factors on fidelity that really impacted child outcome, it was the quantity. The most important factor on whether or not a child made growth or significant growth across the year was how frequently that instruction was delivered. And even though that may seem in some ways a no-brainer, we were surprised. And I think the reason it was surprising is we just didn't realize that delivering a Tier 2 model would be so difficult in some locations. So that's one of the things we learned, is that we really have to figure out the infrastructure to help schools deliver this so that the quantity demands are met, that children get enough instruction. Now, quality of instruction was also important. What we found is that if you had a teacher who was both a high-quality and a high-quantity teacher, if you were a child in that teacher's group, you were going to make very nice outcomes on par with the kind of outcomes we got in our previous tightly controlled studies. They were so we know that when it was done right, those kids did. If the teacher was a moderate quality, then quantity was more important than quality. Teachers at high quality but low quantity had children that did not do as well as those that had high quantity but less quality. And then if you had a teacher that was only moderate quality and low quantity, you essentially, what we saw with those kids, it was as if they hadn't had any intervention at all, which we thought was a problem, because now, the kids now believe that they're failures. So I think this quantity and quality piece is really important to keep in mind as we try to implement intervention. We have to make sure we're ensuring just basic delivery and tracking that as part of what we do in schools. So at the end of this project, we now have a model for what we find to be the critical components that are necessary to have both quantity and quality. And we tend to, I think, in our work with schools, we tend to focus just on teacher expertise. You know, we put the onus, everything is on the teacher. And, of course, the teacher does need to be expert. I'm not downplaying that. But what we find is that if the teacher is an expert but doesn't have good curriculum to support her, she'll probably do better than the teacher that doesn't have the good curriculum, but she'll struggle. So you have to have both a mix of a good scientifically based curriculum or an approach, like the responsive reading was really more of an approach than an actual curriculum, but you had to have that in place. But what we found also is that our teachers, even when we had very experienced teachers who had been teaching for a multitude of years, those teachers with reading degrees and everything else still needed coaching. And that coaching support represented the ability to talk about the challenging kids. Those teachers, even those that really knew reading, often were presented with children who just didn't fit anything they'd ever dealt with before. And so the quality of the coaching really supported the teachers. And ultimately, what we found, and again, this shouldn't be a surprise, but now we have science to support it, is that the leadership in the building and also within the administration as a whole really determined how often and to what quality the teacher was receiving or how much, how good the outcomes were for kids. So as I think about this, it makes me realize that, we always put the burden on teachers, but we need to back up and say, the teachers are one important component. We have to put more emphasis on the leadership and much greater emphasis on providing the support to those teachers who are often working sort of in silos by themselves and not getting the help, but then having all the responsibility for any bad results. The leadership component was the component that explained quantity. Quality was explained through coaching. Quantity was explained through the leadership or the principal. And I think you can probably guess a little bit of why that might be. But I'm going to revisit that in just a little bit. Now, if you'll turn the page to the next slide that says the real world, we found quite a few things that or barriers in the real in the lives of schools. And so it's important that we consider these things as we implement new innovations in schools. The first thing that was actually a surprise to me was just how large teacher mobility can be. Now, these results may not be typical, but it is what we found. If you look at the NIC, we found four things that really impacted teachers' ability to get results with their kids over time. And this was a longitudinal study, so we looked at outcomes both within a year but also across years. We found that the teacher mobility piece of this puzzle was huge and results in needing to change the life cycle model completely, because even in a school that has been doing something for, you know, 25 years, a teacher that's new to the process is still in her initial implementation phase, or his. We found that teachers that got, we randomized coaching, so those teachers that were getting the support really did have better quality measures. The leadership, the teachers who had principals who were supporting their efforts were able to teach more frequently, and the infrastructure was there, meaning that they had the time and the resources available to them to provide this type of Tier 2 instruction in addition to a core. Now let's go back and talk about mobility, so if you'll turn to the next slide. Our numbers were pretty shocking. Now, we did work in 78 schools, but it wasn't necessarily the same teachers across those years, and we added schools in. So in our very first year, we had 45 teachers, and there was one teacher in a school, so teacher equals school in our first year. Now, in our second year, of those 45 teachers, we only had 19 that returned. We added new ones in. It wasn't, in fact, the size of our actual study grew, but of that cohort that was in the 2005-06 year, only 19 had participated the previous year. Now, many of the schools did return. It's not that we were losing schools. It's that the personnel within those schools were turning over. The same thing happened again, where by the third year, we were now to an 83% loss, and by the final year, we only had four of our originally participating teachers participating in the study. And we just weren't prepared. We hadn't thought through the reality of what schools face every day, which is that you're always dealing with a new set of personnel. So that has a lot of lot to say about how we handle staff development and coming back to that need for teacher support. So the second thing we found is that, well, of course, I think we all know this. First and foremost, staff development is not enough. Those teachers that got just our staff development package were able to do a moderately good job, but they were, on average, lower quality and quantity. High teacher mobility also then results in the need for ongoing initial staff development and support year after year after year. And what we find in the school so often is they do a training when the school district implements something new, and then it's seen as, you know, we did that training. There has to be an ongoing focus that everybody that's new into that intervention, whatever it is, even if the school district's been doing it for 10 years, they still have to provide that ongoing initial staff development component for everybody that's new, and then the ongoing support through coaching. And we found that even our most highly expert teachers, you know, were faced with lots of challenges and in many cases may have given up if there wasn't somebody to bounce around ideas and talk through the process of problem solving. So we are quite confident that teachers need the ongoing support. We did randomize our various teachers into one of three coaching conditions, and that's listed on the next slide. We had a traditional on-site face-to-face coaching in the way that all of us think about coaching. We also created a technology-based coaching model, which I'll share with you in just a little bit. And then our control condition was really what we called it on-demand. We initially intended for that condition to be strictly staff development and then they're on their own. However, the principals really were not game for that. So we allowed any teacher in the control condition to receive assistance if they requested it. So it was an on-demand request. There were a few teachers that did actually request quite a bit of assistance, but as you might anticipate, the majority of the teachers in that condition really did not request much. It is also true that some of the teachers in the on-demand condition really did not appear to need much support. And so we have to realize that within each of, when we're dealing with teachers, they're not all the same. Their teachers do need support, but some need less support and some need more. And we found that to be true. And we could look at the range of what teachers were doing without support through that on-demand condition. Now, I'm sharing with you briefly the coaching model that we followed, which is student-focused coaching, which I should have the citation on here, which is Jane Hasbrook and Carolyn Denton's model of coaching. And that process incorporates, it's a data-based coaching model. So we were using, we were using Dibble's data and then data from the interventions themselves to assist us in determining what conversations to have with teachers. In other words, we didn't just hone in or focus in on instructional delivery issues. We honed in on how kids were performing and talking about issues with various children who were perhaps not performing as well, and also making sure we were giving lots of positive strokes for those children who were making great progress. But it was student-focused rather than teacher-focused. That's an important thing to understand in terms of opening up teachers' ability to listen to us, to hear us, because the role of the coach was more like a collaborator, almost like having your own personal counselor in many ways. So it wasn't, they never served in the role of critiquing instruction or in any way, there was nothing punitive associated with coaching is what I'm trying to say. Now, so there was data collection and review, which was done either on the computer or with the coach. The coach observed, and in our technology-based version, we were able to add webcams in and such, so we've created a model where we can actually observe into the classroom from a distance. Teleconferencing or face-to-face conferencing, depending on what model the teacher was in. And then we created a series of video clips and things so that we have each of the interventions had the staff development materials on disk with voiceovers and video clips of every technique. So that was part of both of the models. In the virtual coaching, this was all done through technology. And so we were trying to create the face-to-face model through, but using technology. I'm moving on to, I've shown you the virtual coaching, looking at communications. In the communications, you were looking at a coach face-to-face, and the coach could see you at a conference time, very much like face-to-face, except it was done on the computer. And so there was teleconferencing. There was also chat rooms with the other people that were on your – everybody was on a team, and they had a coach is sort of how it was set up. So the team members chatted with each other, and then there was chats with the – online, you know, discussion boards with the coach as well. Now, at the end of this coaching, what we found is that the on-site coaching and our virtual model were equal on all measures, which we were very excited about because this shows that we could actually provide coaching via distance as well as someone who drives to the building and makes, you know, does that kind of coaching, which was also very effective. We found that both coaching models were better than on-demand on multiple measures, and I've listed them out there. And we also found that teachers in the coaching conditions had higher implementation scores than teachers in the on-demand. And most importantly, the teachers were more likely to have high quantity scores, which we've already suggested were particularly important. So we know that this teacher support really was important to making our interventions happen more like they happened in the original studies. The next piece that could be a barrier or facilitator was the leadership in the building. And the reason that leadership was important was because the leader built the infrastructure. The leader in that building is the person who either created the environment that allowed teachers to provide this instruction or did not. And so they had to really believe and buy into the need for this Tier 2 intervention. And some of our principals did. And some of our principals did not. Obviously, the central administration had because they let us do the research. But we also saw the phenomena that when the central administration really wanted it to happen and felt that it was really important, the principals got that message. And in those districts where the central administration said to the principals, well, you know, do it if you want, and we're much more laissez-faire, we saw the principals then also be much more laissez-faire or not take it to heart in many cases. My favorite story was a principal in a very low SES school here in the Dallas area that looked at me, and here in Texas we have something called the TAX test, which is our high-stakes assessment at third grade, and we're doing all of this work at first grade. And the principal said, well, you know, I get judged on how my kids do in third grade, not in first grade, and so I'm going to put all my resources into third grade tutoring, not first grade tutoring, which I thought was quite distressing. So, and that was a building that we actually had very poor quantity scores for. So that leadership really does matter, because in particular protecting time. Protecting the time seemed to be the most important factor. And we now know for sure that there were effective infrastructure models that were working in buildings, and then there were models that were not. And this is important because as I go around the nation, what I see mostly are the models that we found to be less effective. So that suggests to me that we need to do some changing as a field. Well, we found in schools that had effective infrastructure models that they had already embraced the idea of Tier 2 instruction. They had intervention teachers who delivered that instruction. It was not placed into the lap of the core teacher to provide this more intense Tier 2 instruction in addition to the core. Now, remember, the way we think about Tier 2 is that that we expect core teachers to do some small group instruction during their time, and this would be an addition. So just to clarify that we expect our core teachers to do that, but to do some small group, but the more intense 30 to 40 minutes in addition to the 90 minutes or 120 minutes in the core, we found that if teachers were asked to provide that tier, the ineffective model, if the general ed teacher was asked to do that in addition to her core, they just often did not find the time, that it just got beyond them. They had just too much going on, and they really did. I'm not beating up the teachers. We were, I felt very sad for some of the teachers because they felt so guilty, and yet they couldn't get it in, and they felt very pressured. The effective models they brought in special ed or Title I. They, in some cases, the librarian was the intervention teacher. We had one school where a coach delivered some of this instruction for part of the day when he had some downtime. So they brought additional personnel to bear. And the other thing is that the time in those most effective models, the time was sacrosanct in that building. In some buildings, principals consistently pulled our intervention teachers to be the subs or to cover this, or there was a multitude of things that they were pulled for. You know, one class went on a field trip, so that teacher got to take care of the kids that didn't have permission forms, etc. And what was surprising to us is just how much of that kind of activity went on in buildings that the principal looked at the intervention teacher, when there was an actual intervention teacher, as sort of a standby teacher rather than hiring another sub. And so, but those principals that clearly wanted that intervention to be occurring daily hired subs and brought those people in to cover for other positions rather than pulling in the intervention teachers. So it was both that they had an intervention teacher and that intervention teacher was allowed to do her job. In those models that had that in place, the infrastructure in place, we saw better outcomes for kids. Both, and that is actually true not just for our interventions but also for the scientifically based. So that leadership component is something that I've really come to understand how important it is that we bring the leaders in schools, both at the general central administration level and at the building level, into the conversations about what is necessary to truly improve reading. And we're not talking about just the content of reading, but the infrastructure and delivery of reading, making sure that those times are there, structured and sacrosanct. So, in conclusion, we're going to end up talking about just what we know now about this idea of taking to scale. Ultimately, when we put new innovations in, and I think that anybody that takes on a new innovation hopes that it becomes institutionalized after a few years. Institutionalization meaning that this is what we do in this district and that it's not going to change or flip every few years. And so our initial lifestyle model, you know, does work from a standpoint of a district level. A district may buy a new core program that they're going to implement for the next 5 or 6 years and then perhaps buy the new version that comes out 5 or so years later and put in Tier 2 and have good instruction being delivered, bring up the reading scores. But what's important to understand is that even when that may be true at a district level, it is not true ever at the building level. Within a building, there is this consistent process of going back to implementation and back to implementation and back to implementation for the personnel. And the reason that's important is that we have to help these individuals hit the road running. There is quite an extensive research base that suggests that it takes at least a year for a teacher to truly get good outcomes on an intervention. And if that's true, we're going to be missing the boat because we're having turnover of 50% or so. So we're finding that if we can get the coaching in place and the infrastructure in place, that teachers do have better outcomes in their very first year of intervention, and then they can move into sustaining and maintaining. They stay around longer, too, and they don't leave the field as quickly or put in for teaching changes if they're feeling successful. So in conclusion today, I just want to leave it with the audience to think through your own situations in your own school districts. And I know everybody has their own particular situations that you're dealing with that are not necessarily aligned with what we found. However, you have to consider all the things that we talked about. How are we going to keep the ongoing implementation activities in place, not just do them once? To keep the teacher support systems in place. And this becomes particularly important now that the Reading First monies have disappeared, but are being reallocated. And so, you know, how are we going to access that? You know, should we be pooling money to do virtual coaching so that you can access a truly expert coach and not pay for things like mileage? You know, this leadership development and support, how is the individual school district and the individual state going to support and mentor principals and administrators into what needs to happen here? And finally, you know, it's clear to me that we have to be creative in our funding if we're going to have intervention occurring prior to special education services being rendered for students. So that's everything I have to share with the audience today, and I'm seeing that we're running right up on time as well. So we have a few minutes, I think, for some questions, perhaps. Is there anybody there?
How long did it take you to develop the virtual component?
Well, the virtual coach, we're actually in our version 2 that brought in the webcamming. We started out with just a text-based version, and we've been working on that now for 6 years. So it took a while. But we're willing, we have it, the shell is ready for dissemination as well.
And do you know if other studies are using the virtual component or how common this is?
To my knowledge, no one has as far as I know, and I don't claim to have scoured the research, but I can tell you at the time we were developing it, nobody had done this. And in my review of the literature recently, I don't think there is another group that has put together a coaching model with, you know, the ideas of teleconferencing and webcamming and such.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen some text-based models where people are just chatting, which is actually helpful as well, but this brings it to another level.
Well, I think this is fitting in with the new administration, so go for it.
Well, good. I hope someone notices. Are there other questions?
Were the virtual groups separate, so the virtual group would be, if you were doing the responsive intervention, that would be a separate group from the more structured intervention?
Yes. The coaches, that the individuals that served as coaches actually had been the research teachers for their intervention in the previous studies. that we had done. So we had, so what you have through the virtual coaching is access to an individual who is truly an expert, not just in reading, but of the intervention that you're trying to implement, and has also worked with the kinds of kids and sort of understands the realities of working with these kinds of children, which I think was a big help. Sometimes, you know, teachers, you know, who do you hire to be a coach? The coach can't know everything. So in this model, we assure that the coach is an expert in what you're doing. And these individuals also received a lot of staff development and training on how to be a coach, which goes beyond expertise in the particular content, you know, brings in a lot of listening skills and communication skills and things that may or may not be natural for coaches. So it assures the quality of the coach as well.
Kind of begs for publishing companies to create components that are virtual quality, and can also take a bunch of people and train them in that as part of the publishing contract with the school.
Yeah, the hesitancy on the part of the publishing houses, and I, you know, I'm an author. I work with several publishing houses. The hesitancy there is that you have to pay salary lines for the coaches to really do their jobs, and that gets to be pricey. And so there'd have to be some kind of subscription or something. And they basically don't feel that the market would pay for the coaching. There seems to be a belief that school districts, I hear this from like McGraw-Hill and such, that school districts expect the staff development to be embedded into the cost of the materials. And I think they need to take a chance.
Yeah, and they need to understand how schools don't really work that way.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, I'm very concerned about, you know, like my own intervention, what happens, it's now sold by SRE McGraw-Hill, and they'll do a one-day overview shot and drop the packages off, and it scares me to think what's really happening with my own product. When
oh, yeah.
We know our teachers needed a lot more support.
Oh, yeah.
What do you think schools can do to try and help to affect that change?
Well, I think that if the schools were asking, I mean, from the publishers, if they actually requested this kind of service from the publishers, then the publishers, they're market-driven, market demand.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's the simplest answer. In the meanwhile, you know, this kind of, they are moving to technology-based staff development modules, but those tend to be like online modules that you work through, but they're not support per se, although you can go back and check them easier or review what you learned more easily than you could in a typical workshop. But you don't get that access to a coach. And in our model, we had a portal to, you know, the wireless generation Dibble score, so you could really see your graphs and stuff while you were chatting with your coach and such. So, you know, the links to assessment and things weren't necessarily there. Or aren't there. So I think this is the wave of the future. We're trying to figure out here at SMU how we can make this available to the public. I mean, that's truly where we are with this process, since we've now shown that it really can support teachers.
Did you say your studies were with first grade? Is that where you
Yes,
were
all of the work that we did was in first grade. And it fits within that, you know, in a response to intervention model, which, where you would have three tiers. We were really thinking of this as tier one and tier two in that response to intervention, and trying to reduce the number of kids who need that final tier. So as we think about moving into response to intervention and tiered instruction as a nation, which we are, and Reading First really helped to bring that along, you know, we have to think through all these other issues, which have a lot to do not just with the curriculum we adopt, but the infrastructure and the support piece.
Yes.
I think based on my recent experience last week in Washington, going up to talk to some people on the Education and Labor Committee, they really want to hear from people, and they want to hear about why Reading First type interventions and structure should be maintained. That's
that's a longer story than I'm saying, but
I'll be happy to go talk to them.
I'll email you, Pat, and Dr. Mathis, and talk to you a bit about this.
And I do believe I recognize Sally Grimes' voice.
Is that Sally?
Yes.
Okay. Hi, Sally.
Hi.
I want to thank all of you for joining today. Are there any other final questions or comments about any of the content of today's presentation?
One last thing, I do have manuscripts that are, much of what I presented today is not yet in press, but I am sharing the, we've now submitted for review several of these. We have three different manuscripts from which I pulled, so I'm happy to share those with you as long as you recognize that they're in review and are still in revision, which means they're still in that revisionary process.
And I do see that you included your email on the final slide, so I will just offer that email, if that's okay with you, Dr. Mathis, to anyone who's listening in if they have further questions or would like to stay in contact with you about this. And I just want to personally thank you so much for helping to clarify the quantity and quality piece through the work that you have done. I think that is very important contribution to the work that we do in working with schools and teachers and struggling students.
It emerged as an important piece. We hadn't even thought about
yeah.
it. Darn it.
Yeah, that I think is very important and critical information.
The manuscripts, were they be available?
We have three manuscripts that are currently in review. What that means is that we don't know if they'll be published or not, but I'm still willing to share them.
Yeah, do we need to email you for that sharing? Or
yes, if you'll email me.
Thank you.
Yes, if you would like copies of the report that is in manuscript right now, email Dr. Mathis. She's offered to share those with us.
Thank you so much. This is a fabulous study.
It is.
Thank you.
Thank you. So appreciate it.
And for anyone who's still online, thank you so much for stifling your coughs and everything else while we had this technical problem with their inability to mute at our end. We'll have that worked out by next time, February 12th at 11 o'clock. Eastern Standard Time, Differentiating Reading Instruction with Dr. Shanahan. So this concludes our session today. Thank you very much for joining us. Dr. Mathis?
Yes.
Thanks again. This is Deb.
Oh, yes. I think that went well once we got through the intro.
Oh, yeah. I'm so sorry. Mike Graberitz asked me to do this today, and I was just tickled pink to be able to do it, and so he gave me my script and my directions. And I followed them to a T, and something might have gotten typed wrong.
Yeah,
something, just one little asterisk off or number or something. But I think everyone monitored their phones pretty well. There was only a couple times it was a little there was a little interruption. You handled it very well, and I appreciate it so much.
Do we know how many people participated today?
We will know, yes. I asked the same question if they were able to gather that data, and they know exactly how many people joined in, when, how long they stayed on, and everything. So I will tell the Institute that you're interested in getting that information.
Oh, great. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
Thanks again. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.